Welcome everyone to another insightful discussion celebrating James Baldwin's 100th birthday. I am Dr. Milton Brown, and it is my pleasure to welcome to you this special interview in celebration of the centenary birthday of James Baldwin. Baldwin's eloquent insights on race, identity, and society continue to inspire and challenge us today. His speeches and writings have had a profound impact on individuals and institutions alike, prompting critical reflection and meaningful change. Today we have the privilege of speaking with Amanda Huxtable, a distinguished multi-platform writer, director, and producer with over 25 years of experience in the creative industries. Amanda is a passionate advocate, mentor, and educator who has dedicated her career to diversifying the cultural sector in the United Kingdom. Her work has taken her across UK and around the world, including notable presentations at the National Black Theatre Festival in the USA and script development projects with the British Council in Sierra Leone and Venezuela. As a co-director of Vanitas Arts and Geo Stories, Amanda is at the forefront of developing immersive digital stories that blend audio drama, podcast, film, augmented reality, and GPS-triggered narratives. Her leadership extends to her role as chair of RJC Dance in Leeds and as a long-standing committee member of the Huddersfield Literature Festival. Today, we explore how James Baldwin's powerful words have resonated with Amanda and influenced her personally and her groundbreaking work. Welcome, Amanda, and great to have you in our studio.
Thank you. I really appreciate being invited. Thanks, Milton.
That's a real powerful introduction there about your work. And just before we start talking about James Baldwin, where's the best place you think you've been and why did you get the most out of it as well?
Oh, that's really hard.
That's a tough one.
That's a tough one. I've been in so many places. I've been blessed. You know, I'm going to talk about the UK on that score. I've been around the world, but I'm going to talk about the UK. The thing about being from London, as you can hear, is that I'm not from London. Somebody said to me, you know, where are you based? I said, the UK, United Kingdom. And I've been so blessed because of my work to have travelled across the country and to know the people and to hear their voices and to hear their stories. So, you know, I could talk about Grimsby, Hull, Liverpool, Manchester, Rotherham, Sheffield, all over. And I'm excited. And, you know, it's important to speak about that because people haven't touched with each other. They don't know each other as well as they should do. So the best place is hard to, the lessons, the hard lessons, the good lessons. I started in Manchester. Mm-hmm. So not even Yorkshire, really, you know, across the border, you know. Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But that's where I kind of began my northern journey when I landed at uni. And I was welcomed by the black community within that experience because for a child to, you know, say a child, 18 years at the time, you know, you don't just touch at the university, you go and see where the people them are as well. And when I went into the Wally Ranges and Moss Sides, all those spaces, I understood that actually we're more connected than we can even imagine. I recognised I was home.
I mean, similar kind of work I've done in, you know, Grimsby, Hull, and somewhere in North Yorkshire, Cumbria. It's amazing when you navigate those places as a young African, Caribbean, British male, how enriched you are by it when you reflect on it later on. Do you feel enriched by the experience? You said blessed, but
I do feel enriched. I also feel a little frustrated, I have to say, because I'm like, I can see where we are, you know, connected but not united.
Yeah.
You know?
Great point.
And so when you say best in terms of internationally, then I go to places like Sierra Leone and I'm shocked at how I thought I'd touched down in Montego Bay. The light, the colours, the guys trying to get the bag them, you know, and I'm sure I saw my Uncle Melvin. I was like, hang on now. You know, what happened was obviously is that our people had been there. They travelled from Jamaica to Sierra Leone. That's why we're so connected. So when I got my first plate of food, I was home again.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Similar, Uganda. I couldn't believe I saw some of my homeboys from Huddersfield in Uganda. Same head, same nose, same mannerisms. I'm thinking, yeah. And that's what I mean about being enriched by it, is that you realize we're a very, very small community
very much so. But picking up on that point, it's about being recognised. So, because we look like we're from there, but we're not from there. Because the Black British experience is entirely different, which is what, you know, was really what was being spoken to. James Baldwin spoke a lot about that, how you can't ever go home. And so his kind of conversation about the African nations and African-American was very interesting to me, that diaspora. It's like, actually, how can we have a conversation about the fact that we look like, you know, so when you start to talk, they're like, but you're not from here. You've got to, but I used to be.
My father before my father, that's before my father, my mother.
That's right.
And my mother's mother's was here a long time before we got there. Great. So let's get straight into the discussion about James. How did you first encounter James Baldwin's work and how did it impact on you?
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing because obviously James has written so much for us in terms of, you know, but for me it was about the speeches. Actually, to tell the truth, it was a picture. It was, I'm a visual learner. It was a photograph. And because I knew he was there, but I kind of thought he was a little dry. I was like, I'm not sure if I can get into the writing and this and that because it looks a little bit serious. But I saw a picture of him dancing with Dr. Maya Angelou.
Oh, wow.
Right? I recognized her and I knew it was him and they looked joyful. They looked like they were having a good time. And so in some ways, Dr. Maya Angelou introduced me to go look again at James. I thought if they can have that joy, maybe he's not as serious as I thought. Turned out he was serious, but the man knew how to have a good time. So because of that, I entered into, you know, what's gorgeous, what's lovely is that we now have a multitude of ways of entering into work that's passed. 100 years worth of, you know, if he was still with us, he would have been 100 years. But he left us so much gifts to go back and look at. And thankfully, people recorded it. Witnessed it, wrote it down. There's a lot of that, which is so important. In fact, archives are so essential. So I was able to tap into, when I found the consciousness to go back and find him, to look at that debate at, you know, Cambridge and to check in and see what he said and how he stood up to it. And I'm a person, obviously, as a director, as a storyteller, I want to know how the person said it, what they did, how they stood, what they felt. And so I've been studying and watching him for a long time. So that's how I got into his speeches and debate. His novels and all those, you know, important works, that they're from imagination. And I think for me, imagination is important. In fact, he gave us imagination to break free from what had been given us. But for me, it was that photograph and jury.
Wonderful. Which brings me into the second kind of question. How has James Baldwin's eloquence and passion in his speeches inspired your artistic work? Can you share a specific piece that was directly influenced by his words?
You know, it's about value and principles. So I do have pieces that always speak to both himself, James Baldwin and Maya to a degree. But I think it's about the courage and freedom and imagination. I have a piece that was produced by Vanitas Arts, the company that I'm co-director of, and it's called Persons of Interest. And there are four extraordinary human beings who lived around the time that he lived. You know, there's a woman called Ada Bricktop Smith, who was, you know, she was a woman that created a space in France in 1924, you know, around the times that he was born. She's 30 years, you know, before he even arrived in France. And she's making that space for Langston Hughes and all those gorgeous people that just went, you know what, America, I'll see you in a bit. Yeah, I'm going to make my own world and be as fabulous as I can be. You know, you've got Gladys Bentley, who's from Harlem, the very space that you know, James is from. And she's there as a drag king. I'm like, well, you're not playing. In the 1930s, you know, doing rent parties and all kinds. I imagine that James was there at some point as well across the world. She's only 17 years older than him. So, you know, there's these spaces that people, despite what they were living, were creating, of, you know, to pure freedom, you know. You've got Josephine Baker, clearly she's been adored by the French for many years, but the story that we tell there, written by my colleague Shirley Harris, is about, you know, who Josephine presented herself as, but actually what she was doing, which is freedom fighting, you know, which is just really wonderful. And then Ken Snake Hitch Johnson, which I just love his name. And he was living in London and living his full free life as a man. I think those, the eloquence and the clarity and the absolute freedom to be as brilliant as you want to be, is something I definitely see in James. When I think about listening to him speak about his own life and what he witnessed, you know what I noticed? Man got more and more vexed. He just got...
Well, they all got more vexed.
At Cambridge is there, suited, looking good, looking like ready, you know, and that's all good because we know how to present, we know how to be, you know, we can use the tools that we've been gifted. We've got who we grew, you know, what we grew up with. We've got the Western ways. We've got the spirit. We've got whatever way it is, you're going to hear it. Mm-hmm. And he landed what he had to land and won the vote, right? But he was very serious.
Yeah.
He then, as you go through some of this, one called Brave and the Free, he's just getting more and more like, you know, I'm sick and tired of your foolish questions. I'm sick and tired of actually having to answer these questions. In fact, I don't even believe in the construct you've given me, and you're still working with this thing you've been given. You know, and you can see that to the point where obviously we ride right through to his life, and you can see that he is, it's harming him. You can see it in his face.
Yeah.
You know, there's a point when he says, I've lost my friends. And you're asking me about it, right? You know, Medica's gone, Malcolm's gone, and Martin's gone.
Yeah.
You know, and you're asking me to write. I've then told you what I thought, and that still happened. You know, and he ended up in hospital because of that, because he's in there fighting for us.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a strange period, the civil rights movement, because, you know, Malcolm X was seen as the most angriest man in America, but he moved more to the center, and Luther King was seen as the king of love who moved more to the right of radicalism.
And went to the Labour Party, the Labour movement.
That's right.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
And then in the end, both of them were shot by the assassin's bullet. So I can see why I would say James Baldwin was in the center of this, but on the fringes, because these two pillars were so charismatic. But
what I think is interesting in terms of where James was in the rooms where it happened.
That's right.
So they had conversations with absolutely influenced. You could imagine I reckon he looked at some of them speeches and helped him out with that. No doubt. Because he's a wordsmith.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And Martin wasn't in the room with him for no reason. It would definitely would have been like, so what would there would have been debate. He was a philosopher, you could tell that. He saw the promised land before Martin, I believe. You know?
I guess he did, because he had that intersectionality of he's male, he's black, and he was gay.
Yeah.
So he probably hit all the corners of white America now.
He was living his free life. Yeah. What I think is really exciting and important to remember about James is also he loved women. So regardless of what he chose, you know, what I mean by that. He has eight brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. He adored them all. He loved children. Mm-hmm. He always spoke about that. And I think he spoke about that, having listened again to what he's about, because he remembered the age of consciousness. He was a little kid, loving life, minding his business. Then he understood the world he was in as a black boy.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted that to be no more part of any black child's life ever again, where they weren't free. We're all doing that now. We're doing that work now to make sure our children are as free as they were born to be. And, you know, that awful, painful place of understanding where they actually are and what society has given them is something no one should have to live through. But we're still here.
Mm-hmm. And do you take that into your work then, in terms of seeing everybody, feeling everybody as part of the big family, the human race?
I think it's the only way we can get through the pain of it. I mean, you know, they call it Christianity, they call it humanity, you know. For me, let the person tell you who they are, you know. It's interesting in terms of our recent unrest. You want to call it red, you can call it down, whatever you want to call it, right? And so if the right wing member becomes your family, what does that look like? Now, I'm not going to turn any in the cheek and no one's going to be mashing me down in my family. But if it turns out that we're in one big conversation, then some of our family members we cannot speak with because they want to do us harm. You know, so who is it we can speak with? Who's ready? You know, I'm just, if we looked at that as a, because the issue, of course, is the ones that want to do our harm is that they're not seeing us as family or even human beings. We're not people to be spoken to. So that means we're not, you know, it's an interesting basis to be at.
But I also think to reach that point where you can embrace everyone and anyone, It's it must be beautiful and liberating.
Must be. I'm not quite there yet, I have to say. But I mean, and James was very much a person of, what he did is deconstruction. So he said, somebody called me the N-word, or somebody invented this thing called black. They invented the thing called white in order to basically allow this legal framework of us being able to work for people. I mean, it's very broad-based way of putting it, but it's very helpful. It's like, in order for you to justify your behaviour, and I loved how they spoke, him and Dickie Giovanni spoke in a big, broad, poetic way. It wasn't a literal way. It was, if your brother, if your sister, if your lover, that's how they spoke. So it's like, you know, you have denied me my humanity in order for you to gain. So now we know that, I'm not going to ask you for my money because I've already got it. I'm not asking you for it.
Wholeheartedly agree. That sounds like a Garvey as well. Yeah. Okay, so Baldwin often spoke about the power of language and storytelling in challenging societal norms. How do you use your art to address issues of social justice, identity, race, in a way that aligns with Baldwin's vision?
I suppose, I mean, that's a big one. And I think it's about centering the conversation. So, like, you know, if you think about this country, United Kingdom, right? Only very recently, in recent history, we've stopped centering London as the center of our world. You know, the North has got a conversation to be had, but Scotland for sure, Wales too, you know? So, and Northern Ireland is a whole other, as you know, story. So, for me, it's the intersectionality and the identity conversations about ensuring that any story I have in front of them, that they are the center. It's not about, sometimes when we tell what is such a thing as a black story, but, you know, we end up talking about race and we aren't talking about that person's identity of who, you know, after them done being black, right? Who else are they? You know, otherwise it's always going to be, what's the word? It's about the challenge and the difficulty. Listen, we live in a world where, especially when we're talking about the American story, then, you know, unfortunately, our brothers and sisters are in harm's way every day. Mm-hmm. We've got a list of names we couldn't, from George Floyd onwards. We've got, before John's, you know, it's rough. Mm-hmm. It's rough. So there's no denying that we are in the fight.
Yeah.
But while we are in the fight, we are living and have relationships and difficulties and troubles and joy and all kinds. So what does that mean? Otherwise, every story is going to be about the struggle as opposed to our lives. Does that make sense?
Of course it does.
Well, I mean, you know.
But drilling down, I'm trying to occupy the two spaces that in the civil rights movement and where we are now in 2024, we're still fighting for equality, justice, discrimination. Mm. Empathy from my brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. Systemic racism.
Yeah.
Institutional racism. Mm. I kind of feel in awe of people like James Baldwin and Martin Luther King and the rest of them. How did you manage to hold your peace and still go out there and eloquently share a message of hope?
You know, I don't know if they held the peace. I think they had to work hard at it, right? And all of us do.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's moments of absolute despair. We talked about despair is a really interesting word. And like, you know, like I said, the unrest, it's like, oh, what is that? You're frightened, you're worried, you're concerned, you're thinking of it, all this work I've done. I have to say, after living a few decades now, disappointing, don't even touch it about where we got to, right? But how you get up and move again is the conversation, you know? Otherwise you're giving up and then you're becoming segregated in every way. There's a protection to be had though, because you shouldn't have to put up with foolishness. You know, I do think that's, you know, for me, James said many times, this is what he's been gifted to do. This is his gig. He ain't no better than the truck driver, but he happens to be good at what, and absolutely, definitely said that in terms of the man dug trenches. And he wasn't, you know, he couldn't do that very well. So he had to go find what he could do. And his family clearly, you know, they sent him money when he went to France in 24, you know, a poor with $40 in his pocket.
Yeah.
They must have known something. It's worth the chance. It's worth the hope. It's worth the, just, you know, when you're sending bright one.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know this. And it's that's like, right. They might just get to the promised land and bring back more for it.
Bring back more for
it. You get you. So that's exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. Just like our people that landed here from the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Yes, you know?
But it's interesting. I, in, I think it's Notes of a Native Son, when he ended up in France, it was the first time he felt, not as a black man, but as a writer.
Yeah. An American at that.
And an American at that,
yeah.
Okay, Baldwin had a unique ability in his speeches to convey the complexities of human experience, particularly the intersectionality of race, gender, and sexuality. How do you incorporate these themes into your artwork and your work? And what impact do you hope it has on your audiences and the folks you work with?
Yeah, that's been a real push for us at the NCLES Arts. And also just as my kind of support any writer, the complexity in life. You know, if we get that layer, I remember back in the day when I was unpacking story, we were just glad to be in the room, right? You know, we were just, we're like, yeah, we're in together and we'll just, you know, so somebody just walk on the stage and they're called black and you just start laughing. You're like, what are we laughing at? We're just glad you're here. After that, yeah, you got to hold the space. We've got too much Netflix, that every time, every opportunity to tell a story for us to tell poor, rubbish, tired, flatline stories. It's just not good enough to people. We've got to dig a bit deeper. And when it comes down to storytelling, and I'm not going to, I don't want to be, you know, bossy, but the Caribbean's pretty good at it. You know, I come from a family that didn't go to no university to learn about how to tell a story, but they can tell it. That's where I came from. So, what you know, any one of my aunties and uncle, they got some really good ways of telling me some the lessons. You know, you're unpacking.
Agree on it.
Yes, very much so. So then we think we began by then going and study it. To study telling story. And it's important that we bring those two wonderful opportunities to really land complexity. Because that then, what you want to do is encourage conversation for the rest of our days. I know for a fact, good or bad, I'm going to use roots as an example, good or bad, real or not, whatever, we're still talking about it. We're still having a conversation about the characters. And you remember, if the characters are really good and strong, people will speak about them for the rest of our days. Like Dickensian, it's just important for us to, you know, really fly. Because the reason why the stories are there and the characters are there is for us to learn something.
Well, that brings me on to the next question quite nicely, because James Baldwin emphasized the importance of confronting uncomfortable truths in his speeches. How do you navigate the balance between creating art that is both aesthetically pleasing and deeply provocative, encouraging viewers to reflect on complex topics?
First of all, you got to know that you're doing that. You got to know your choices. If you want to just, I mean, otherwise, what's the point in what you're doing?
No, I agree. But have you ever had anybody saying that was too much, or leaving feeling, you know, unglued and upset what they've just seen in that you've produced in some of your work with other artists?
To be honest, that's where I'm going. You know, I just, at the end of the day, if we don't push them places, what is the purpose? I'm so blessed to be here after a few decades that I'm pushing beyond where I've pushed before. I get, you know, my work previous to working with both Vanitas Arts and Geo Stories and being a director, you know, I've had the opportunity to work within venues and theatre spaces and all those things. And you tell the work, thankfully, you know, that you believe in. Marcia Lane wrote Bag Lady back in the day when we had Hidden Gems, you know, and we pushed, we said some things. But the issue is, as James said, the things have been said, it's just who's listening. So it wasn't like we said stuff that black people have been talking about. I say black, it's a bit monolithic, and I don't want to be like I'm standing like I'm representing everybody. But we said, we were talking about Trayvon at the time, right? Trayvon Martin lost his life, was murdered, brutally murdered. And one of the conversations we had was, and it was a dreadful conversation, it was, do we change the name every time it happened? You know, that hits hard.
Yes.
Right? And Marcia, like, we said, no, because you know what? We marked the moment, because people won't know when it was written. And look how far we've come already since that.
Yeah.
And we know what was happening before. It's not good enough. I personally believe, in terms of my art, if we're not on the edge, I don't know what's the point. When I say edge, like comedy, the thing that makes you go, I'm resident, says so. Yes, they said so, because that's where we're going. That's who we are. Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah. Okay, so his speeches often calls for reimagining American identity. In your artistic practice, how do you explore the concept of identity, and what does Baldwin's legacy mean to you in your work?
Yeah.
No. You kind of touched on it.
We have a little bit, but you know, when it comes down to even saying Black British Milton,
yeah,
that's been a journey for us, isn't it?
Yeah. Can I ask how you describe your identity?
I'm still working through it, you know? I've taken on the Black British for a while now. I've taken that on.
Yeah, yeah.
Never really went into the European things, but you know, I just didn't. Mm-hmm. Never called myself English. It's not something I can quite hold at this point in time.
No.
But Black British will hold for now. I'm definitely, my Jamaican heritage is a very important part of what my parents, you know, that's who I was raised.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was in London, but it might as well have been a little mini Jamaica. Dad had kalaloo in it, kalaloo, you know, the garden. You know, so, and that's what I ate the food, I had the sound system in the house. It was as it was, set. You know, it wasn't an unfamiliar situation for me.
I guess when it comes to Jane Baldwin's work and my identity, I like to think I'm an African Caribbean British descendant.
All right.
That incorporates
yeah.
my ancestry, my mum and dad, mm-hmm. and where I was born.
Get it?
And again, I always he said I love America so much I can be its biggest critic.
Yes, absolutely. He's got the right to do so for yeah. sure, for sure.
And for me, then, if we don't claim, I'm going back to reimagining the American identity. If we don't claim this country as our home, how can we then reimagine it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like you asked me to introduce where I was from, and I'm like, I said, United Kingdom. And this is where my family chose to, you know, I was born here, yeah? But I take the world, really, because we are internationally. So I know that, I know the African, I know my DNA, and also because of the facts of the history of it all, Black British means that the, you know, the colony conversation is part of that. But when it comes down to what I have studied, what I know, the land, Yorkshire, all them things, then I don't have it. 2007,
yeah.
right, was a major year in terms of the bicentenary of the end of the slave trade.
Yeah.
A major year in terms of my art practice, because I did a piece of work again with Marcy Lane, which was Lost and Found. And what that made me do as a individual was do the work. I went and did my DNA, and I travelled up and down the country to museums. At the time, before it was fashionable, to go and find the archives and the artefacts and the conversation and the unpacking. Liverpool, Bristol, I went everywhere, right? What it did was free me. It totally freed me. I went around like, yes, man, the British Library is mine. You know, I was like, yes, this land is mine. They're not begging for anything. I'm not trying to. It's mine done already because it was paid for by my people. You know, it's simple as that. There was a pride. There was beyond regret. You can't even talk about regret. Absolute painful how it happened. But you know, like I say, you can't unlive history. You can't, you know, that's what it is. This is where we are now. So there's no argument. Anybody wants to come to me, tell me about go home, it's like, I'm done here. I'm here. Because I built this space, and also Jamaica, and also Ghana, yeah. and Sierra Leone. All those spaces are my home.
Yeah. A good friend of mine, Roy Aitken, similar to you, he did the work, like I did the work. And Roy says, now I am, is an indigenous citizen of the world. That's all right. And I went, I like that.
Yeah, take it.
Because now nobody can plonk him anywhere.
It's what it is. Well, at the end of the day, we're connecting family and humanity anyway. So, you know, there's no borders, but that's another story.
Yeah. Okay, my last question here, the legacy and future, as we look to the future, what lessons from Baldwin's speeches are crucial for you and the next generation of activists and artists?
Well, I've touched on what the world belongs to you.
Yeah.
You know, there's a freeness, a free... Even, you know, when James described himself, he never took on the labels.
No.
He wouldn't have it. You know, people calling him, he said, look, what is gay? What is that? He didn't talk it. He loved who he loved. And that's his business. Even that, I'm majorly respect. There's no coming out for James. He lived his life. And I really loved that. in terms of the lessons and legacy, I think there's something about, for me, I keep thinking about freedom, but the complexity of life. I think if you think you've told the story, go again. You know, because I've done that. Somebody's told the story. Go again. Go deeper.
Wouldn't that be as important as well to passing it on to the next generation as well, if you keep telling the story and enriching the story with more knowledge?
Yeah, one of the things I would definitely talk about is intergenerational conversation. Something James, you know, he's speaking to Nikki Giovanni. She was 28. He was touching that. It's not hardly generational, but a 28-year-old woman speaking to a 50-year-old man, and they were speaking as peers. And I love that. Yeah. You know, it's really important that we are sharing what we know from where we are. That is really important.
Okay, I want to say a big thank you, Amanda, for sharing your insights and experience with us today. Your dedication to storytelling and cultural diversification is truly inspiring. As we celebrate James Baldwin's legacy, we are reminded of the enduring power of his words to provoke thought and inspire change. Amanda, your contributions to this conversation have added invaluable depth to our understanding. Thank you for being with us and for your continued commitment to amplifying diverse voices in your art. Thank you so much.
Thank you.